All right. Well, where to start? So every once in a while, I find myself, you know, as many of you have been in the sangha for any period of time, and I am subject to seasonal affective disorder, and sometimes just find myself feeling depressed for no good reason. So if I'm feeling depressed for no good reason, sometimes I think, well, you know, I really ought to have something to feel depressed about. And so that's when I whip out the five daily recollections. Somehow it usually winds up making me feel better, I'm not sure. So at any rate, that's what we're going to talk about this evening. So this set of teachings dates back to, the Buddha, when he attained freedom, you know, ultimate freedom, he went through a certain period, and there are different ways to understand the stories around there. One story is that somebody, came down from the Deva realm, actually one of the Brahmas, and said, because he had just achieved Nirvana, and he was just hanging out, kind of blissed out, and he had said, well, this is pretty good, I've worked real hard, and now I'm here, so now all I got to do is hang out till I die. But this, this non-corporeal being came down and said, well, there are many people out there in the world who would benefit from your teachings. And the Buddha responds, well, that was a pretty rough ride. And I don't really think that there are very many people out there that would want to have anything to do with a path that's this challenging. But then this being, beseeches him nonetheless. He said, well, there are those out there who are similarly inclined as you were and who also have the dedication and the interest and the capability. And so, you ought to sort of give it a shot. Another way to understand that story is it was just the Buddha kind of internally reflecting and feeling some ambivalence about whether he ought to try teaching this stuff, because it was difficult for him to attain that freedom, and he really wasn't sure whether, number one, whether many others were capable of it, and secondly, whether he was going to be able to teach it effectively. And at first he didn't. His first couple of tries, once he decided to get out on the road and try sharing what he'd learned, he ran to a couple of folks that he used to do extreme ascetic practices with back in the boonies, and he started trying to tell them about his discovery. And they say, we don't have anything to learn from you. You start eating again. They could see that, that he was taking better care of himself. And so that didn't go well. And then eventually he ran across five other people that he had practiced with for a long time out in the bush on the road. And they knew him and they trusted him. And so they listened carefully to what he had to say, and they became his first five disciples, the origins of the Buddha Sangha. So when he started to teach, one of the things he decided to do early on was simply tell his own story, was to recapitulate the means by which he discovered the truth of the existence of suffering, and the origins of suffering, and the means by which it might be brought to an end. And in recapitulating his own story, he started with the shock and fear that he experienced the first time he went out into the wider world. He was born to the ruling class and a minor principality in northeastern India before it had actually been unified into a country. And he led quite the pampered, sheltered life during his upbringing. And that was sort of the custom at the time, until they had somebody who was being trained to be a ruler, became very comfortable with palace life. And then at some point, they would take them out into the wider world and they would show them how rotten the rest of the people in the kingdom had it. That you are a member of a privileged high caste that has power over this kingdom, okay? should you choose to take your place in the caste and become part of the ruling class and rule this kingdom and maintain the order that we have here. Otherwise, look what's in store for you. If you choose not to take your role in your caste and the leadership of the society, you're going to lead a hard life. And so it was kind of a way, actually, of keeping in line the next generation of leaders so they would realize how good they had it and that they had to play their own role in maintaining the social order as it was if they wanted to maintain their privileged status. So that was the desired effect, but sometimes it kind of backfires, and that's what happened with the Buddha. When he saw how the rest of the world lived for the first time, he became profoundly disturbed, became quite depressed, actually, and anxious. And that constellation of feelings that he had, he later came to call it by the Pali word Samvega, S-A-M-V-E-G-A. And it's translated sometimes as anxiety or as fear. The translation that Bhikkhu Bodhi uses is called, it's a phrase called sense of urgency. And what created this sense of urgency? Well, when he first went out with, one of the provisioners into the town, for the first time he saw somebody who was a very advanced age. Okay. He saw somebody who was deathly ill. For the first time, because in the palace, people, when they were getting really old and whatnot, they no longer had a privileged place in the palace. Unless they were members of the royal family, they kind of had to go away, go to some, except they didn't have retirement homes. They just, go out and live out your life and out in the periphery somewhere. Same with ill people. Anyone got really, really sick within the palace, they scooted them off someplace, where they either recovered or died. And the same thing with death. So he was carefully protected from all these things. And it's also sort of a story not only of his society, but of course ours as well. In our country, we spend literally billions of dollars every year on products that are supposed to make us look younger than we are. Right? So there's a disinclination to acknowledge the aging process. Healthcare, of course, is another multi-billion-dollar business. Not focused so much necessarily on keeping healthy, but on, fixing you up if you get sick. There's a hell of a lot more money in that, for one thing. But it is, and then another thing that we're really kind of fixated on, and sort of like the this conclusion that they wanted all the noblemen to come to when they were going through this training and seeing how rough the rest of the world had it was, looks like it's better to be rich and healthy than it is to be poor and sick, right? So being sick is a bummer, and it's one that we don't pay any more attention to than we need to, and if we get sick, we want to do everything we possibly can to get well, so there's that one. And then death. Okay. Just as with, our efforts to make ourselves appear to be younger than we are, even after somebody dies, there is this oftentimes, and at least in traditional funeral practice, an effort to, kind of dress them up, like put nice clothes on and paint their faces up, kind of like they're going to a party, right? But not to really acknowledge the fact, whoa, they're gone, they're dead. Nobody home there anymore. And if they didn't fix them all up to look nice, they'd look, kind of creepy, right? If you've ever had occasion to see a body after its life has left it for any period of time, especially if somebody goes out on a sort of a wasting disease, not so pretty a picture. Not so pretty a picture. So he realized that these things were disturbing to him, that they created this sense of fear, of anxiety, fear of aging, fear of infirmity, and fear of death. Likewise, when he started to really look deeply into the nature of cause and effect, he began to have these insights into the nature of karma. You know, there was this opportunity to see the kind of suffering that he had not wanted to acknowledge caused by having said and done unskillful things. It's another source of anxiety or a sense of urgency in Sambhaga, is the realization that there is the suffering that occurs because of our past unskillful words and deeds. That we're now, that the suffering is being visited on both us and on others as a result. Another source of anxiety or suffering, and there are actually about seven or eight of them, the realm of Sambhaga, as the teaching goes, is fear of the future consequences of past actions. So there is anxiety or concern, suffering in the moment occasioned by unskillful things you've done or said in the past, the fruits of which are being experienced by you now. This other form, however, has got to do with knowing that back there somewhere, either very recently or a longer time ago, you said or did something that was pretty off, but the effects of it have not yet come to fruition. But you fear that they're about to. That somewhere down the road you're going to get your comeuppance. Another form of anxiety or fear is fear of the future consequences of future actions. That, you know, given our past experience, chances are somewhere down the road we're going to blow it. You know, we're going to say or do something unskillful, and we're going to suffer as a result, and others may suffer as a result as well. Okay. And then a final form of anxiety or fear comprising somebody again is this what's called fear of loss of nutriment. And by that is simply meant the need to keep oneself nourished and safe and at ease, you know, protected from want. Okay. And so as the Buddha realized that all these forces were at work, he realized this is suffering. These are in fact some of the core causes of suffering in life. However, what he also saw, and this is where, you know, that was the realization that suffering happens, okay. The second noble truth as it dawned on him was this. He realized that if you are born, you're going to age and grow old. Somewhere along the line, you may well succumb to some kind of illness or infirmity or trauma. And we have very good data to support the extreme likelihood that at the end of your life, you're going to die. And these are simply facts of life. It's how things are. It's our dharma. It's the reality of what it means to inhabit a corporeal body in this world, on this physical plane. Why then, the Buddha asked, are these causes of suffering? It's not the facts of aging, infirmity, and death. It's the mind's reaction to them. You know, it's what I sometimes call the ego's prime directive. Seek pleasure, avoid pain, live forever. That seems to be what the discursive mind is all about. Ain't gonna happen. Sometimes pain is unavoidable, sometimes pleasure is unattainable, and life has an end. Our individual lives do, right? So then he began to investigate, okay, why is it that the mind is resistant to these truths? what is it in the mind that is resistant to these truths? And it, thereupon he discovered what it is in the mind that's resistant to these truths is the constructed self. It's the discursive mind, it's the ego that is created by the mind that then turns and finds unsatisfactory the circumstances in which we find ourselves. So in his teachings, aging, infirmity, death are not sources of suffering. It's the mind's response to those truths that is the source of suffering. And so he realized that rather than try to pretend like those things are not going to happen, that they are not happening, you know, that we're not aging, that we're not subject to illness and infirmity, that we're not going to die someday. Okay? That the ego, the discursive mind, spends a whole lot of time and effort and money sometimes trying to ignore those truths. And so what the Buddha taught was that the way to overcome the suffering occasioned by contemplation of those things is instead of trying to ignore them or pretend they're not going to happen, is turn toward them, open to them, embrace them, acknowledge their reality, surrender to them. Okay. And in so doing, you surrender the ego to those truths. Okay. When you do that, what spontaneously arises is compassion, self-compassion. So the Buddha said, you know, and it's the same thing James Baldwin said, the civil rights leader in the 1960s, when somebody said, how is it you're able to do this leadership work when your life is being threatened daily, you know, and you might lose your life at any time, you know. And he said, you can't be controlled by your fear. Whatever it is you're afraid of, walk toward it. And that's exactly what the Buddha taught. He said, if you fear these things, turn toward them. Examine the nature of your fear. Who is afraid? Who is afraid of aging? Who is afraid of becoming ill or being injured? Who is afraid of dying? Who dies? Title of Stephen Levine's book, you know, where he goes straight there. Okay. Who dies? What dies, ultimately, in addition to, you know, the chi leaving the body, is the ego. Right? So one of the ways that insight meditation and other Buddhist meditation practice are sometimes described as death practice. In that, we're gradually surrendering the ego to wisdom and compassion. You know, acknowledging the truth of these things, acknowledging maybe our fear of them, understanding where the fear comes from, and then that having been done, there becomes this sense of acceptance. Oh, I see the fear. I understand the fear. I know where it's coming from. I know that part of mind, of my mind from which it's emanating. Okay. And once having recognized that, it's possible to have compassion for the part of your mind that fears. Oh, there's the fear. There's the anxiety generated by the discursive mind, by the sense of self. And here, within the same field, is compassion for that aspect of my own mind that is suffering, that is afraid, like comforting a frightened child. Right? And so that's what we're seeking to cultivate in the mind. Okay? And that's the exact purpose of the five daily recollections. I am of a nature to die. I am of a nature to age, not God beyond aging. I am subject to illness and infirmity, not God beyond illness and infirmity. I am of a nature to die. I have not God beyond death. I will be parted from all that is dear and delightful to me. And then is great teaching on karma. I am born of my actions. I am heir to my actions. My actions are the womb from which I have sprung. My actions are my relations, which is to say the quality of our being, both with ourselves and with others, is how we behave toward them, how we behave toward ourselves. My actions are my protection. When we speak and act and live with integrity, we create an aura of integrity, and it tends to encourage those with whom we come into contact to speak and act in the same way. Not always, but if they're so inclined, there's a way of being when we are really kind of in the zone, you know, when we are in the Dharma, that as we interact with others, it tends to bring forth similar responses from them if they're in a place where they're sensitive to where we're coming from. It's really powerful stuff, right? My actions are my relations. My actions are my protection. You act with wholesome intention, with integrity. Speak with wholesome intention, with integrity. That becomes your source of protection. No harm can come to you that has been created by you. You know, when someone once asked Gandhi, you know, who are the most inscrutable enemies or adversaries that he's faced? You know, and he said, well, you know, there were the Rajas when we were trying to, you know, kind of break down the caste system. And then there were the British. You know, he spoke about, you know, these various generals he came up against in the course of leading his nonviolent protests. He said, I could abide them. I eventually was able to help them see, you know, the wisdom of our path. He said, but this fellow Mohandas K. Gandhi, I have very little control over him. Then he realized that unchecked, he was his own worst adversary. You know? And that he had to be right with himself before he could stand up, you know, in a confrontational situation with anyone else. So the Buddha advises doing that, you know, this practice, because it's simply acknowledging reality, simply acknowledging things as they are. And as we do the practice, if we feel the fear arise, if we feel the anxiety kind of coming up, if we realize that there's a part of the mind that does not want things to be that way, then that becomes a part of us that needs to likewise be acknowledged, you know, the fear and the anxiety, if it's there, that likewise needs to be acknowledged and to be accepted, to be treated with respect. Because that too is the reality of where we are in that moment. Okay. And so it doesn't mean that we are, you know, unskilled on the path if we feel fear, if we feel anxiety when we do this practice. It means that we have come up to our edge, we have come to the tender edge of self. And it's tender because when we're doing Dharma practice, the self is constantly in the process of becoming more porous, and of having less deterministic control over how we think and how we speak and how we act. You know, we've got to dance with the one that brought you. So we got a constructed self as part of our hardwiring, you know, when we were born. It's what we do with it now, you know. If that's where the fear is coming from, that's where the anxiety is coming from, that's where the suffering is coming from, you know, in the Buddha's teaching. And so this way of practice is simply a way of bringing into focus the root causes, the sources of that anxiety and that fear. When it's there, it's not always there. And in fact, sometimes doing this practice can dispel it, actually. Because what you've done is to come into a place of relaxation and acceptance of the truth, you know, of the Dharma, of the way things are. And then having done that, it's as if everything then begins to take care of itself. You know, and you find yourself to be more at peace with these realities, to feel more equanimity about our situation, to be less fearful of it. You know. We do this to the extent that we can. There are aspects of the hardwiring of the body and the mind-body process, of course, that have some designed-in limitations. You know, it's like the Tibetans, when they refer to the three bodies, you know, the physical body and the rainbow body and then the great body, the kayas, they talk about the physical body as what they call it, the fear body. And by that they mean, you know, this physical body on earth that worried about loss of nutriment and all those kinds of things. That's the nature of this physical body. It's anxious about its own existence. And that simply needs to be accepted. It just sort of comes along with how things are. But accepting it is way different than obsessing over it or wishing that it were not so. So this practice of the five daily recollections is one of simply surrendering in an open-hearted and a compassionate way, self-compassionate way to things as they are. The Buddha, if you want to dig into these texts a little bit, the discourses of the Buddha, his teachings, are organized into these different sets of books called Nikayas, which just means collections. And this one is in a collection called the Anguttara Nikaya. And the Anguttara Nikaya, the English translation of that name is the Numerical Discourses. And all it is, it's very, you know, the different collections of discourses are organized in different ways. This is the Buddha's book of lists of lists. You know, Four Noble Truths, Five Daily Recollections. So if you go to book 5 in the Anguttara Nikaya and you look at clause 57, you'll see this teaching laid out, the teaching of Sambhaga and the Five Daily Recollections. And then the next section says, and just as I am of a nature to age, am of a nature, subject to illness and infirmity, subject to dying, okay, subject to loss, so too are all around me. Right? And that second part of the teaching on the part of the Buddha was equally important, because he said, it's not just about me. It's not just about my anxiety about aging, my fear of illness, my fear of death, my fear of loss. It's something that's universally shared. And so when you can come to the realization that not just we, but those around us are also carrying those same anxieties to varying degrees, they'd also many times prefer not to age, or to appear to not be aging at any rate, you know, to avoid becoming ill, okay. To avoid dying. There's this, when we were living in Berkeley, there was this house that we'd drive by every day that had this this van, and it was a refrigerated van, and it was this fellow that would go out. If somebody had signed up for the service, the moment they died, they'd put them on ice. And they had this warehouse where they would keep bodies frozen for like decades, right? And so every time, you know, somebody died, he'd go out on a call in his van, he'd put this body in there and they go freeze it. The idea being that at some point in the future, they're gonna find some cure for whatever they died from and be able to bring him back to life again. I don't know how well bonded that company is. I don't know if it's even still in existence. You know? But that was the idea, you know, as people who, even as they were dying, were unwilling to accept that. You know, they wanted to get put on ice in the hopes of, you know, being born again, literally. Okay. So that's the teaching. It may be one that's familiar to some of you, it may be new to some of you. I would for sure like for us to spend some time now reflecting on that teaching. If you have any questions about it or any of your own personal experiences practicing it, please, this is a good time to share. Is it your new favorite? Please.
There was something that happened over 10 years ago where someone I knew very, very well died quite young.
Yes.
And that had a profound effect on me. And the first response was that fear of realizing that, you know, she had gone ahead of all of her contemporaries. We're all going to be following her. Sort of,
yes.
And it's taken me a long time to catch glimpses of the truth of living in the present, and that in fact there is no reason to fear.
Right.
At all. I'm still just getting glimpses.
Yes. Oh.
That into everyday existence, isn't it?
The Buddha calls Samvega a really important element of the initiation of the practice. He said it was those realizations that got me started, that sense of urgency. And so you can think about all the ways we try to pretend that sense of urgency isn't there. You know, all the ways you try to ignore it or deny it or whatever, and they only lead to more suffering. And so the Buddha said, the sooner you're able to turn to these truths and let them in and realize where the anxiety is coming from, the sooner you can begin to fundamentally transform your own consciousness in relationship to these. This also, you know, it's not the kind of teaching that I tend to offer right after an introductory series. This is more kind of like graduate school level. You know, it's a teaching. The Buddha, when he was training others to teach, you know, and one of the vows that he suggested that they take is, I will teach a graduated discourse. And by that he meant keep it simple, start out slow, and then you share things as they are capable of being understood, as they are capable of being taken in, as they are capable of being used in a skillful way. Because doing those practices can also lead to nihilistic despair, you know, if you're doing them from the perspective of a sense of self, you know, and that in fact historically is where the transition was made between existentialism and for the Beat generation into the Dharma. You know, a lot of the poets and whatnot from the Beat generation wound up, you know, becoming very, very wise Buddhist teachers, you know, and poets like Allen Ginsberg and Gary Snyder and folks like that, because the existential quest and the existential perspective had taken them as far as they could go. And, you know, pretty much what was at the end of that road is a sense of despair and worthlessness, right?
Yeah. My mind is Herman Hesse.
Yes, yeah, of course. You know, it can take you up to a certain place and then it's like, whoa, okay, what's next? You know, some of the beats drank themselves to death, like Jack Kerouac. Some of them got strung out on smack, and of course that was, Allen Ginsberg did both, you know. First he got strung out on smack, and then he discovered Buddhism, and that turned out to be a much healthier path for him to follow. But it's heavy stuff, and it needs to be treated with great respect. Because when you're doing it alone, you know, like the Buddha said, you know, if it's coming, if the work is coming from a place of self, it can make one feel profoundly lonely. You know. Profoundly isolated, and somehow feeling sort of worse off than when you started. It seems, you know, so well, what's this about? The Buddha taught cessation of suffering. Yeah, you know, what is this? And it takes a little bit of insight and some practice and working with those phrases to realize that that is about the end of suffering. You know, it is about liberation. And basically brings forth, it gives you a taste of the third noble truth, you know, the fact that suffering can be brought to an end. I gave this talk a few years ago in Boulder, and one of the people who was in the group that night was a woman who was a chaplain in a local hospital. And she was saying, you know, somehow I don't see myself going in to the, you know, the room of a terminally ill patient and sharing this teaching. I said, well, you're right. You know, a lot of what Buddha Dharma is about, whether, you know, just studying, you know, as a yogi, or perhaps sharing it or teaching it sometime, is getting a sense of what teachings are most appropriate to what needs. When it's most useful to do what practice or to investigate what realm of teaching. So I said, in the circumstance you're describing, there's a very strong case to be made for metta practice, you know, for cultivation of karuna and equanimity, right? Not this. This practice is for, it's a way to be in a compassionate way with those feelings of anxiety and urgency when they arise. It's interesting or as rough-edged as that, you know, as those phrases seem, they ultimately can become a source of comfort, you know, because you're getting grounded in the truth of things as they are. And then as you allow yourself to experience that grounding, the fear or the anxiety around them tends to dissipate. And it becomes possible to be with these truths from more of a place of not self or not understanding. It really can be a powerful generator of self-compassion. And then as the Buddha taught that, he said, the next logical unfolding in the mind is compassion, not only for yourself, but for others as well. Because they're all carrying the same stuff. Yes, please.
All what you're saying is fine, but where I am is not there. I my backpacking days are over, my motorcycle days are over.
Good.
My four wheeling days are over. My fall off the ladder. You know, my plumbing doesn't work as well as it should. I'm right in the middle of the suck.
Right. That there is difficulty, there is a sense of loss of not being able to do the things that we used to do, that we used to take pleasure in doing. There is a loss of capacity. Absolutely, it comes along with aging. It's just how things are. Okay, it's not, and you know, we can take as good care of ourselves as we can. Aging is still going to happen. You know, like. The comedian Red Fox was giving a doing stand-up at the University of Texas once a few years ago. He said, you know, y'all health food fanatics are going to feel pretty silly 50 years now from now when you're lying in bed dying of nothing. Take care of yourself, but first you're alive and then you're not. That's kind of how it is, right? So it's how we relate to that, how we relate to the loss of community. I feel the same thing. I feel grief sometimes, you know, for the loss of what I used to be able to do. And so it's possible to grieve that loss. It's also possible to fondly remember what it was like when you could do those things. It's a real, what I find is that when I can get into that particular groove, it seems to have to do with the time that I was doing those things when I was in the moment, when I was fully appreciating what it was I was doing that I loved, you know, whether it being in the backcountry or, you know, things of that nature. And then those memories come, they shine, they come through. Oh, right. That was a wonderful time. I'm so glad that having been able to do that was part of my life. It's not now, but it was. And it, you know, my love of nature is no less than it was. I just can't enjoy it in quite the same way. Yeah, there was a question back here.
You're saying that makes me think about 3 days ago, I went up to Bales to spend the night with a friend, and I didn't ski, I didn't do anything outdoors, and when I was driving back in a snowstorm, I started thinking about when I would go up on the mountain in a snowstorm, when you couldn't see a darn thing, and I absolutely loved it. And then I thought about a moment when I was taking a private ski lesson on a quite steep hill, and there was about this much space between this tree and this tree. And the instructor said to me, now, Enid, we are only dealing with the space from here to here. And I thought, well, that is a great metaphor for life. I've never forgotten that moment.
Steer between the trees. Good. Please.
So is the suggested practice to like meditate on these things daily or to just be with them when they arise?
Mm-hmm. Good question. Which is, the Buddha called them the five daily recollections for a reason. What his view in offering the teaching was that the more comfortable we become with these realities, the less anxious we will be about them. Okay, the more accepting we can become of them. Okay. So it has the effect of kind of soothing the self to the point where, just like the little kid, you know, I don't do them every day. You know, I do find it really useful to do them periodically. Because I notice that when I don't do them for a long time, that sense of anxiety can begin to accrue again. And then I realize that it's time to get grounded again. It's a wonderful grounding practice, basically. Please.
I found when I was doing them every day for a while, that after a while it got stale. Mm-hmm. And it was a little bit like, you know, some people have a table race, which is the same meal after meal after meal, and it's almost mindless. So I find that I have to back off of that for it to have more of it.
Yes, thank you. Good advice. I'd say if you're new to that practice, or if you're especially if you're finding resistance to doing it, it's really helpful to develop a relationship with that practice, you know, so that you can make it part of how you see the world. Doesn't necessarily, I think doing it every day for the world might be good, but like Kim was saying, anything can kind of get old after a while. As soon as it starts to lose its meaning or its juice or its resonance, and set it aside. But it's one of those things that's always worth coming back to. It's like another way of taking your spiritual vital signs. Kind of, you know, what's it like when you... Okay, yes, please.
You referred to James Baldwin, and I watched the film a lot that came out several months ago called I Am Not Your Negro. Mm-hmm. And it is an incredible film, and my first thought was, up until today, I think, right here, hearing your lesson, was every member of Congress should have to watch this. Or every elected official should have to watch this. The only trouble is they wouldn't be able to hear it, because they're not ready for it. Mm-hmm. But I was ready for it, and I watched it, and I spread the word to my friends and said, watch this movie. I mean, every American should watch this movie. It's just, he was such an incredibly gifted, talented, wise, poetic person.
It is.
So if you get a chance, it's at the library. Yeah. I Am Not Your Negro.
One of the voices of our modern history. Yes, please.
Thank you.
Yes?
A lot of my Christian and Muslim friends, sorry, I'm losing my voice. A lot of my Muslim and Christian friends are consoled by knowing that there's an afterlife.
Yes.
And I don't really consider myself a Christian anymore, but I was just wondering what you have to say about that.
Yes. Yes, thank you. In the Buddha's teachings, he makes often reference to what he calls the deathless. So when, in the Hindu understanding of reincarnation, for instance, or the Muslim or the Christian understanding of a heaven, you know, being reunited with the Heavenly Father or something. The Buddha instead spoke of that which can never die because it was never born. So it is I don't want to even make it feel like, don't give corporal being, a kind of a primordial suchness or isness. Things as they've always been and always will be, okay, that what dies is that which has been brought into being by the mind. So if you can lay to rest that which has been brought into being by the mind, then you experience the deathless. You experience the absence of self. And so then the question of an afterlife isn't so relevant, because there's no thing to be alive, you know. And his teaching is that we can experience the deathless now. We can experience the deathless regularly, you know, as part of our life on earth at this point in time, right? And that whenever we experience the deathless, you know, we have in fact gotten beyond dying, because we're coming from a place of understanding that no one dies. And that's going to have to do it for. Right, so now that we all know how to die. Let's please take our sitting posture just one more time. We are of a nature to age. We have not gotten beyond. we are subject to illness and infirmity. We have not gotten beyond illness and infirmity. We are of a nature to die. We have not gotten beyond death. We will be parted from all that is dear and delightful to us. We are born of our karma. We are heir to our karma. Our actions are the womb from which we have sprung. Our actions are our relations, and our actions are our protection. All of our actions, both wholesome and unwholesome, skillful and unskillful, of these we shall become the heirs. Have a safe journey home.